Group Captain Eccles, Reel 4. Anything else before we leave Wick to go to Iceland? Anything else you remember about your time there?
Yes, there was one rather amusing incident. Before the war, I had been taking part in car rallies and had always been very interested in motoring activities. And I was always ready to volunteer for anything that was being asked. I was acting as the squadron adjutant. I can't remember why the adjutant was away, but anyway, I was acting as squadron adjutant. And some friends of mine, unknown to me, played a joke by putting a signal in my in tray asking for volunteers to go and command an armoured car unit in Ethiopia, or in Abyssinia, which was at that time still fairly active. Needless to say, I rose to the bait and applied for the job. So then I was put through a medical test and with the sick quarters at Wick and given the full set of overseas injections. I was then kitted out with tropical KD and sent on leave. When I was on leave, after about 2 or 3 days, I was recalled to the unit, only to be told the whole thing was a hoax. However, I was still the acting adjutant, and as such, was responsible for moving all the ground crew when the squadron deployed to Iceland. I had an acting assistant adjutant with me, a fellow called Wade, who's known as Dad Wade, and he went on ahead with the ground equipment to get it put into the troop ship, which was then in Liverpool. And I was to join the ship with all the ground crew at Gurk a few days later. We marched out of the airfield at Wick and through the town to the railway station, making our departure well known to all the local residents, to our special train at the station, only to find marching towards us from the opposite direction was an army column who claimed it was their train. And it was. However, the authorities decided that they could manage to crowd us all into the one train, and that when we got to Wick, they would have laid on another train for us to go on to Gurk. When we changed trains at Gurk, at Inverness, I sat in the front compartment by the engine driver, and the engine driver I was introduced to and told him where I was, and it was dark, and off we set. And I was sleeping, it was cold, and the train had stopped at some station, and the engine driver opened the door and said, "Did you say Gurk or Greenock?" And I said, "Gurk." And he shouted down the platform, "It's Gurk, Bill." So obviously the signalman then did the necessary. And when we arrived at Gurk, we were not exactly welcome, because all the other troops had embarked the day before, and we were in fact 24 hours late in arriving. The ship was called the Volendam, a Dutch ship which had been torpedoed with a lot of school children on board. I don't think any were drowned or lost, and the ship was repaired. It was now on a first voyage after being repaired. It was still therefore not converted as a troop ship. And my acting adjutant, against all odds, had withstood the attacks of all the army and retained for me my single cabin, deluxe, which he said was reserved for his adjutant. And I was deeply grateful. We arrived in Iceland and...
What was the voyage like? Was it rough or...?
No, the voyage was perfectly all right, and it was just an overnight trip, from what I can remember.
Now, where were you going to in Iceland? This Kaldaness.
Kaldaness, yes.
Where's that?
Kaldaness is southeast of Reykjavik, with a range of mountains in between. It was an airfield built by... in fact, it was the only airfield in Iceland, and it had been built by the army for the RAF, and was, at the time we arrived, consisted of just one main runway of crushed lava dust. The surrounding area being mostly a bog. And the perimeter was a fast-flowing large river. The facilities were very primitive. Bell tents again. An old farmhouse had been taken over as the officers' mess, and a number of Nissen huts had been put up for accommodation for aircrew, ground crew, and everybody else.
Now, why had you been moved there? I mean, what was it? You know, what was wrong with Wick?
We had moved there in order to give escort to convoys coming across from America further west than was possible from the UK. And it was very interesting. Not many people know that in 1941, when we went out there, the Americans had taken over from the British Army the occupation of Iceland at our request, so that our troops could be used elsewhere. And the US Navy was unofficially giving escort to British convoys. The US, as it was then, the US Army Air Corps brought in a squadron of fighter aircraft, which were based for a while at Caledonis, with the task of defending the neutrality of Iceland and given order to shoot down any German aircraft they saw. Why they weren't given order to shoot down the RAF, I don't know. We got on extremely well with the Americans. In fact, I had my top button of a US Marine officer, and he had my top button on his uniform. There was nothing but goodwill. The US Navy also were operating flying boats from Reykjavik.
So there was no trouble at all with the Americans, as far between your men and the, and I don't just mean the officers, I mean between the men.
There was no trouble at all. The Americans were most helpful. It was rather strange that at that time, the so-called war experience that we had was regarded by the Americans as being vital, as they had no experience at all. And the American forces were, in fact, very small, so much so that we looked upon ourselves as being the equals of the Americans.
And just to make this clear, this was well before the Americans joined the war. Absolutely.
Yes, I'll come with some incidents in a minute, if you want.
Now, what about... So your main role was convoy escort, was it, from there?
Yes, by this time... we did actually do a very small amount of reconnaissance in reconnaissance of the pack ice.
Well, tell us about that first. Then,
but 99% of our work was now convoy escort.
Okay, convoy escort. Tell me about it then. I mean, it's pretty much the same, I would imagine. But
well, yes, except that here we were right in the middle of the traffic. The fast convoys or slow convoys going in and out were all passing through our area. They may have started in different parts of the UK, although later on most of them started from Liverpool. Whilst at Wick, convoys just turned up here and there on a small scale. Now it was much bigger business. And I'm sure that there were times when I escorted a convoy of 100 ships with only one escort. It was a very hard-pressed time. The US Navy did not officially escort the convoys, they just happened to be in the area.
Now, did this mean you were flying a lot more hours as well?
Not really, because it was just that we were doing a different task. But we were fully occupied. There was a fairly consistent activity. There were very few days, except maybe when it was impossible weather, when we were not flying at normal standards.
So you'd be doing an escort pretty well daily?
Well, not for myself. I mean, other crews would be.
So how many flights would you make? So, was it a flight every...
I would normally be doing about 15 flights a month whilst I was in Iceland. Some of them were not convoy escorts, some of them were simple things like air tests and the like. But I'd be flying on 15 days in the month.
And what would a typical trip be like?
A typical trip would be that we would take off from Caledonis. This was when we went out, was the beginning of the summer, therefore there was not all that much darkness. And we'd take off, fly at 1,000 feet to where we had been briefed at the position the convoy would be. This might be 400 or 500 miles out. And the important thing was to meet the convoy. I suppose probably 7 times out of 10 we did meet it. Having arrived at the convoy, it was much the same as before at Wick, of doing a search in those days rather more formally, in which we would fly up to say 20 miles ahead of the convoy and come back again, doing a kind of a square pattern as we flew out and flew back, and then go around the tail of the convoy to see if there were any U-boats on the surface following it, and then round the circuit again, and do that for the length of time that we were on task, which would vary according to the distance the convoy was from Caledonis.
And then back.
Yes, and then back. And then to be debriefed on the situation, such as whether we met or didn't meet the convoy, and if we did meet the convoy, were there any incidents to report.
How rigorous were the debriefings? I mean...
Well, they were fairly routine, because most of the convoy escorts were pretty routine as well. But I'll come to one or two incidents that went on, which were slightly different.
What would you wear?
I think at this time, battle dress had just come out, and we got what was virtually a free issue of battle dress, the same as the airmen were wearing. As far as I remember... apart from a Mae West, we just flew in a battle dress.
You weren't cold, then, obviously.
The Hudson had was a very warm aircraft. We had good cabin heating.
So what's next, then? A couple of incidents?
Yes, one or two incidents. I'll just give you the dates now. These are quite interesting incidents. About the middle of 1941... a unit from the Crown Film Unit arrived, making a film called Coastal Command, in which we were asked to participate with our aircraft, including flying an aircraft with a camera on board. This was an interesting exercise and led me to meet the unit director, Jack Lee, who later on went to be a very well-known film director, one of his better films being A Town Like Alice.
Now, what were they actually doing, the Crown lot?
The Crown Film Unit was a government information unit, making films. One of the famous ones was Target for Tonight. And they made a lot of these sort of films for general public use during the war.
And what did they film of you? How did you participate in the film?
The story of the film of Coastal Command involves attacking enemy units, and the particular bit we were expected to do was to fly three Hudsons in formation with the mountains of Iceland in the background, and then later on over the sea, and then do a peel off from the formation and dive down as if we were attacking a ship. That was all.
And they were filming from?
They were filming from a camera aircraft, which we were also flying. Now, the next incident is that on the 26th of August 1941, I had, with Joe Owen King, as my usual co-pilot in those days, been detailed to fly down to Wick on an anti-submarine sweep, stay overnight, and carry out an anti-submarine sweep the next day on return. It so happened that we were also to pick up a couple of barrels of beer and a few other things. On the way back, I was navigating, and the wireless operator had intercepted a message. In those days, off Iceland, there were great periods of areas where it was impossible for an aircraft to get its message through to base. And in this case, another aircraft of ours couldn't get its message to base, but our chap picked it up and passed it on. And then he gave me the message, which was in code, and I decoded the message, and it said, "Send destroyer to pick up crew, surrendered U-boat, position so-and-so." I looked at my map and could see that, in fact, the position was about 20 miles away from where we were, just slightly, about 20, 30 degrees to port. So I said to Joe, who was flying, what was going on, and I said, "It's about," I pointed out onto the horizon, and lo and behold, we could see a Hudson circling low down in the distance. So we went over there, and there was the Hudson, and there was the U-boat on the surface. And I went back and got out the handheld camera and took a couple of pictures. Didn't bother to take any more, because I thought the other aircraft would be taking plenty of them. And anyway, we had to go on with our mission.
Do you know which U-boat it was?
Yes, it was the U-570. And it so happened that the photographs that I took were the only photographs that came out. None of the photographs taken by the other aircraft came out, because in those days there was a great shortage of handheld cameras. And to make good the shortage, the RAF had obtained a number of Leica 35mm cameras. And the other crew had a Leica, and they didn't know how to operate it. And unfortunately, they didn't pull out the lens into focus when they took the pictures, so nothing came out. Thus, the two pictures that I took were the pictures that covered the world international press thereafter. The U-boat was taken in tow by an Admiralty tug and towed into Reykjavik. In fact, the next day we were on another operation and came across it. On this occasion I was flying and Joe took the pictures, and he just happened to take a picture at the very moment that a Royal Navy officer in a Carling float was tying up alongside this semi-surfaced U-boat to take over command. Anyway, the U-boat was captured intact. It turned out that the damage that had been caused by the aircraft, that it's a long story and I'm not going to go into it, that had caused the U-boat to surrender, wasn't as serious as they thought. But because they thought they had been holed, and the inside of the submarine was full of seawater, and the fact that seawater on batteries produces chlorine made it necessary for the entire crew to get into the conning tower and batten down the hatches. But it turned out later that it wasn't holed, and the U-boat was perfectly all right and sailed later on in the war as HMS Graf.
Can I just ask you about your co-pilot, Joe Owen King?
Yes.
It? Two words?
Yes, Owen hyphen King, who died, incidentally, about a month ago.
What was he like? I mean, you know, he was your co-pilot. How close did you get to him? What was he like as a bloke?
Joe and I were great chums. We hit it off very well together when we were flying. And he had been an apprentice with Siemens Engineering in Germany before the war. He was a couple of years older than me and spoke good fluent German.
Another pilot officer, was he, or was he?
We were both pilot officers. No, I was by this time I was a flying officer. He was a pilot officer. And we used to go off on weekends together. We had an unofficial system that we got a weekend off every other weekend. And on one occasion I remember going off with Joe on our weekend to Reykjavik. Reykjavik was dry. The Borg Hotel was the only hotel. And the beer you got, polar beer, was 1% alcohol. But however, we took hip flasks with us and were able to fortify them. Although the Icelandic government, naturally enough, as we had invaded the country, felt they had to do something. They made it a rule that there was to be no fraternizing. However, this didn't stop Joe and I from meeting a couple of delightful girls inside the Borg and getting to know them from weekends onwards. But that's another story.
Were the Icelandics, I mean, not talking about those two, but I mean, were they generally unfriendly?
No,
or
not at all.
What was their sort of basic, how were they with you? They were meant to be not fraternising, but...
Yeah, they were perfectly all right. The cooperation was excellent. There was no distance at all. I mean, we got on as well with the Icelandic people as we did with the Americans. We didn't see many Icelandic people because we had no cause to come across them.
And later on, there was trouble between them and the Americans. Was that apparent then?
No. The trouble was only very limited here and there. If you get down to it, it's like the odd bad apple in a barrel there. There were no real long-lasting problems. There were occasions when the American general had to write a letter of apology and things like that, but it wasn't by any means the standard practice.
And now, you were going to tell the three incidents.
Yeah, right. Now, the next incident was on the 4th of September, just a few days later. And on this occasion, one of our aircraft on its way to an anti-submarine escort west of Iceland came across a U-boat on the surface, which he attacked. By the time he got in to attack it, the U-boat had crash-dived, and in fact all he was able to do was to bomb on the swirl, and it didn't have much effect. Nearby was a destroyer, which he contacted by Aldous lamp, which was our standard method of communicating, and it turned out it was a US Navy ship. At that time, the pilot had to return to base because he was of endurance. It was a standard practice in the squadron always to have on standby what we called a strike aircraft. And any time a U-boat was seen, the strike aircraft was immediately scrambled. And on this day, Joe Owen King and I were the pilots of the strike aircraft, so off we went. We arrived on the scene, or where the US destroyer was. We knew nothing about it except it was American. I decided that it was no good using the long-winded Aldous lamp to establish communication. So I told my wireless operator to set up our radio for voice, our main radio for voice transmission on the international distress frequency, which he did, and then told me it's all set up. I then, not having any call signs, I then simply said, airplane calling ship, do you read? And immediately, loud and clear, we were in contact. And they reported that they had an Aztec contact, 1,000 yards, dead ahead, 2 knots. So I flew figure eights over what I assumed was 1,000 yards dead ahead, with my bomb doors open, just in case a periscope appeared. Because America was not at the stage in the war, the ship, which turned out to be the USS Greer, could not carry out the attack. And in the meantime, HMS Watchman was sent out from Reykjavik to carry out the kill. After an hour or two of circling over the 1,000 yards ahead of the Greer, I went off to see where the watchman was and home it onto the Greer. I found the watchman, gave it a bearing using my oldest lamp, and returned to the Greer. As I got within about 5 miles of the Greer, she suddenly went to full speed ahead, dropped a pattern of depth charges, did a sharp 360-degree turn starboard, and stopped dead. So I called up and said, "What's happening?" And they said, "We've lost contact." Well, at that point, I went and dropped a smoke float and a sea marker over the swirl where the depth charges had gone off. And the watchman had arrived by this time, and the two ships then started to carry out a search. And I was relieved by another aircraft and had to return to base. On returning to base, I was briefed before I was debriefed. I was briefed, had I seen the Greer being attacked? And if I had not seen the Greer being attacked, was it possible that if the Germans were using electric torpedoes, they wouldn't have made any wash, and therefore I couldn't have seen it? I was then debriefed and said that I hadn't seen the attack. The outcome of this incident was quite amazing. At that time, Churchill was doing all he could to get America to provide as much assistance and war material to us as possible. Congress was not being very helpful, although President Roosevelt was. The outcome of this attack was that President Roosevelt, in a radio broadcast, a fireside chat, issued what was known later as his rattlesnake speech, in which he was so appalled at what the Germans had done by attacking a US Navy ship that he authorized the US Navy from then on to attack on sight any German ship they saw. This pleased America, and Congress immediately changed its tack and started being much more supportive of the British war effort and much less insular.
But in fact, from what the Greer had just decided to do it on its own.
No, it had been attacked.
It had been attacked.
Yes. But this comes out later, because we didn't know that at the time. But they said they'd been attacked, and later, after the war, it was turned out to be true.
So they'd been debriefing, in case they'd briefed you before your debriefing, but in actual fact, it had been.
Yeah, attacked. Yes.